Hello and welcome to the Healthy Herb Podcast, a place of information and inspiration for the home herbalist. I'm Bridget Doherty of the Solidago Herb School, coming to you from a bridged island on the coast of Maine. In today's show, I'm talking about coffee, which is also the Plant Wonder Collective's Herb of the Month. Before we get started, I want you to know I'm not a doctor, nor do I diagnose or treat people. What I share is based on my own experience and what I've learned from my mentors. Ultimately, I want you to be empowered in seeking and achieving your own version of optimum health. I want you to be inspired to connect and relate to the common plants that grow all around you. Together, let's make home herbalism be as common in the everyday household as cooking a healthy meal. Now, without further ado, let's have some fun and dig in. Well, this episode of the pod is dedicated to coffee and is inspired by the Plant Wonder Collective's Herb of the Month for March. And yes, it's the tail end of March, but I have been working all month basically on getting to know coffee and pulling together some research and information for you, which I am excited to divulge throughout this episode. In case you're not familiar with the Plant Wonder Collective, it's a group of creators, herbalists, gardeners, foodies, bakers, crafters, artists, educators, and witchy women on a mission to encourage you to deepen your connection to plants. They share a robust array of imaginative ideas from varied perspectives, along with morsels of knowledge about each plant of the month. They have an Instagram page, which is the repository of their free collective work, and that's at Plant Wonder Collective. And my goal in working with the Plant Wonder Collective is to produce at least one podcast for every plant of the month that they do. And I started this last month. And ideally, my podcast would come out earlier in the month, but it seems that I just spend the whole month getting to know the herb of the month better, gathering the info to share with you. And so it seems to work well that if you are following along with the Plant Wonder Collective and working on getting to know an herb, their herb of the month in depth for that month, that you can use this podcast as a way, as kind of a culmination of your study, and to compare notes and to see what you've learned and what I've learned. And hopefully my wish is that these Plant of the Month podcast episodes really do help to enhance your own personal study and also just to give a grand overview of the herb of the month. I also provide my unedited and unabridged notes that I base my podcast off of, that I'm looking at as I'm talking to you, for their Patreon membership page. And I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end of the pod, but you can just, search Patreon and Plant Wonder Collective and it will get you there surely. So let's dive into coffee. And coffee, wow, this has been such an interesting herb to study compared to all of the other herbs that I love to relate to and study. I am a coffee drinker. I drink coffee daily and I do love it. And it is an herb. Coffee is an herb. And I know that a lot of people don't really consider it or think about it as an herb. But really, it's arguably the most popular herb, at least in the United States, and one of the most powerful or potent in everyday common use. Yet it's not in any of my herb books, except maybe 5 different herb books out of hundreds that I have. And 2 of those herb books are all about botanical safety and contraindications, so which I will get into those as we progress through the episode as well. So I find it interesting that, you know, we have this really common herb that people that don't even consider themselves as working with herbal medicine or even necessarily believing in herbal medicine drink on a daily basis and reap the benefits of, and maybe if they drink too much of it, maybe also reap some side effects from as well. I remember one day in my yoga class years ago, there was a woman that took the class, and she's, you know, a community member here, and her husband is a retired doctor. And I remember she just, she's like, "Oh, you're Bridget, you're an herbalist. Oh, how interesting." She's like, "Yeah, but you know, I don't even really think I believe in herbs." And I don't know, when people tell me that, of course, because it's like such a huge part of my life, I'm a little stunned and just don't even know how to respond to that. But I know that that is a thought that a lot of people have. But one of the easiest response to that is, do you drink coffee? Do you have effects from coffee? That is an herbal medicine. That is an herb that is causing a reaction in your body. How could you say that herbs don't have effects on our body, that you don't believe in them, when it's a very, very common thing that we work with on a daily basis? That's one take on it. Also, coffee is one of the strongest herbs out there that's consumed on a daily basis, so much so that James Duke, a botanist, a really well-known herbalist and botanist who has since passed on, may you rest in peace, he would compare herbs on a coffee scale to qualify or quantitate the safety of herbal medicine or of specific herbs in comparison to coffee. So he wrote the Handbook of Medicinal Herbs, and in the second edition, which you can just Google that, James Duke Handbook of Medicinal Herbs, and the whole book is online for free that you can look at. It's a huge, basically just a huge reference source for hundreds of herbs out there. But in his introduction, he says that, you know, he follows a safety score where he, next to each herb in his basic encyclopedia, he'll write an X, a plus, two pluses, or three pluses. And an X means I don't recommend taking it at all, or realize that it is so dangerous that it should not be taken without expert guidance. But for litigious reasons, I give some, and this is his words exactly that I quote out of the book, I give some potent medicinal herbs the X, amateurs beware. And then he goes on to say a single plus indicates that I do not consider that the herb is overall as safe as coffee. And then I score two pluses for those herbs I think of overall as being as safe as coffee, and three pluses for those herbs I believe to be safer than coffee. In the first edition, I related the plus sign to a cup of coffee, figuring that one, two, or three cups per day of an herbal tea from the herb would be as safe as one, two, or three cups per day of coffee, which, you know, I think is a great comparison, because I, you know, people get, and this is now me talking, but people, you know, get so fearful of herbs. And I think it's natural. I mean, I think it's because maybe it comes from an understanding of herbs and the paradigm shift from drugs as medicine to herbs as medicine, and thinking, well, if herbs are medicine, then they must be as powerful or dangerous as drugs are. But really, when we break it down and we compare herbs to coffee, which is a very powerful herb, but yet it's one that people consume in massive quantities without any concern or thought, even though it is one of the more quote-unquote dangerous herbs out there in comparison to all of the other herbs that are commonly available and used medicinally today. So I think that's a great first perspective as we dive into getting to know coffee and also just herbal medicine in general, is that, you know, let's consider mint or whatever, motherwort or hawthorn or any of these other herbs in comparison to coffee. Would you be fearful of drinking coffee in this instance? Are you afraid that coffee is going to interact with your medications? And how does that compare to, you know, a very mild, nutritive, nourishing herb versus a really strongly stimulating herb like coffee. So coffee is in the family Rubiaceae, which I find interesting to me because that's the same family that madder, bedstraw, and sweet woodruff are also in. Very different plants than coffee, very different medicinal effects than coffee, but this family specifically has 611 genera within it. And coffee is, of course, in the genus Coffea. And it's a shrub. It has a small tree, mostly very kind of scrawny shrubs, native to tropical Asia and Africa. And there are over 120 species of Coffea. And there are two main species that are traded in the mass market and grown and consumed by the general world population. There are a few others as well, but much less so. So they're the two main species of coffee that are grown and consumed are Arabica, which is about 60 to 80% of the coffee on the current market, and it's the preferred flavor profile. It's a little bit less caffeine than the other species that is grown and used a lot on the market, which is Robusta, also known as Cannephora. And that's 20 to 40% of the market, and it's higher in caffeine. It's used more in blends and for instant coffee. So the Arabica bean is more widespread as far as growing regions than the Robusta, but it's also more delicate, harder to grow, more kind of picky as far as where it's grown and more vulnerable to pests, and also being more affected by climate change than the Robusta. So the Arabica requires a cool subtropical climate, and it likes to grow at higher elevations, 2,000 to 6,500 feet, and it needs a lot of moisture. So cool, you know, tropical, rainy, humid places. And it also needs shade. So you hear shade-grown coffee. It tends to really like shade or to be cropped in with other trees and plants as well. It's mostly grown in Latin America, Eastern Africa, Asia, and Arabia are the leader producers of the Arabica coffee. And then there's the Robusta bean. And as its name suggests, it's a hardier plant, and it can grow at lower altitudes all the way from sea level to 2,000 feet. And the Robusta coffee, it's cheaper to produce. You can grow it on flat ground. Therefore, you can kind of more easily mass grow it and with machinery kind of harvest and tend it in the fields. Whereas the more like on the mountainsides, the shade-grown coffee, it's very labor-intensive. The Robusta coffee is cheaper to produce, has twice the caffeine content of the Arabica. It's typically the bean of choice for inexpensive commercial coffee brands. It grows in Western and Central Africa, Southeast Asia, and Brazil are the major producers of the Robusta coffee beans. And it also is, as I said earlier, it's what is dehydrated and turned into like the instant coffee that will just dissolve in water as well. Coffee itself in general contains 1,000 or more different botanical compounds, which is not a surprise because I think most plants contain lots and lots of different compounds within it. Some of the ones that we are happy about are the caffeine, obviously, B12, also known as riboflavin, magnesium, polyphenols, which are highly antioxidant and anti-inflammatory, potassium, and then there's another range of different antioxidants as well. So obviously the caffeine is what we tend to really enjoy. And I think also is probably sourced a lot from coffee and extracted and turned into a drug or added to different energy drinks or whatnot on its own. And that's where it gets more dangerous than I think when it's in its natural state within coffee. Caffeine is also found in lots of different parts of the plant, the leaves, as well as the seed. It's even in the nectar and the flowers, and it's really found throughout the plant, but 74% higher in the bean. So caffeine is an alkaloid that actually protects the plant against predators, which would make sense that they would have it in the seed, because the seed is the baby of the plant, or will become a baby plant. And so that's where a lot of plants actually put their more caustic or poisonous constituents, which tend to be alkaloids, in their seeds to protect the next generation. The really other interesting thing that I find about the benefits to the plant of containing caffeine is not only does it protect them from predatory insects and probably diseases, I would assume, but it also attracts pollinators to the white flowers. It attracts bees. The bees enjoy, it would seem, having the caffeine in the nectar of the flower. And there's a couple different reasons that this is thought to be. One is that the bees, so they return to flowers that they know have caffeine, more so than ones that they don't. And that caffeine might turn on a switch in their little tiny bee brain that allows them to more easily kind of be awake and more easily note and notice and recognize and remember the smell of that flower. But also, maybe it gives them a little buzz for that bee, and it helps them to have more energy to gather more food as they travel around, which, interestingly enough, would also benefit the coffee plant if the bees have more energy to fly around to more coffee plants all in one go. So it's mutually beneficial. And it's very similar to humans. So the caffeine is beneficial to humans. We find it very stimulating and really helps our own personal endurance. And therefore, we grow a whole lot of this plant. We provide it with nutrition. We provide it with water. We provide it with wonderful places to grow. And then we spread it all over the world. So the fact that the coffee plant produces caffeine has been a huge boon to it, to its ability to survive on this planet. So caffeine is addictive. And did the plant create this to make animals be addicted to and dependent on this plant, to help it to proliferate? Very interesting question. A common statistic that's thrown around a lot when talked about how prolific coffee is in global commerce is, but it's also debated, and I'll get into that, is that coffee is the number two commodity traded in the world, second only to oil or petroleum, and that it's the most valuable legally traded commodity in the world, second to oil. This statistic basically dates back to the 1970s. It says coffee has been incorrectly described by many, including the historian Mark Pendergrast, who really brought this statistic worldwide, or made it popular, I guess, as the world's second most legally traded commodity. Instead, what coffee was back then in the 70s and up until about 2000 is that it was the second most valuable commodity exported by developing countries or third world countries. So this fact was derived from the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development commodity yearbooks, which showed the third world commodity exports by value in the period from 1970 to 1998, with crude oil in first place, coffee in second, and then followed by sugar, cotton, and others. By 2004, coffee still is a major export commodity and a top agricultural export for 12 different countries. But potentially, like in the world, it would maybe be the seventh largest legal agricultural export by value in 2005. So still very far up there. But when you just see that statistic thrown around, it is a stunning stat. And who knows? It's hard to tell. I guess now it's hard for them to even come up with a right number because it's hard to even tell how to categorize what a developing country is these days, apparently. So even now it might be a bit lower on the totem pole from number two from developing countries to maybe number 15 on the totem pole next to hardwood logs, bananas, and gold. Needless to say, coffee is still a very hot commodity. Pun intended, around the world. So coffee traditionally is consumed alongside or instead of breakfast by many people at home or when they're out at diners, coffee houses, restaurants. It's served at the end of a formal meal, normally with dessert as well, especially in restaurants and at dinner parties. And then there's the classic coffee break, which, you know, the British have their tea time and Americans made popular coffee break during World War II industrial era. And I'll get back to that in a moment as well. But ever since, coffee has become popular in both Europe and America, at least, and probably around the world, I would imagine. Definitely in the Middle East and in Asia, there have been coffee houses or coffee shops, cafes that focus on just selling coffee and maybe some baked goods along with it. And they became hubs of community, hubs of revolutions, actually, even, where people would gather and talk and or be creative together. And we still see that today in a lot of ways. So let's get into the history of coffee a bit. So it's thought that coffee is quite possibly native to originally to Ethiopia, or at least the, and I apologize for any of my mispronunciations as I go through that. That is just my own innocence, I guess. But the Oromo people are the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia, and they lay claim to the earliest use of coffee. So for the Oromo, coffee was actually a staple food in their diet. They did not drink coffee, but instead they would crush the fruits and the seeds of the coffee plant and combine them with animal fat to make sort of like an energy ball that they could easily transport and consume as necessary for energy and even if they ever needed to fight or for warriors or what have you. And in the Wagathana religion, which is the indigenous religion of the Oromo people, Waga is the one God, the creator of all. He's benevolent, omnipotent, omniscient, and very similar to the Judeo-Christian God in that sense, but considered to be, you know, a dark-skinned God. The Oromo have two myths about coffee, and it's told that coffee was one of the first things that were brought to the earth from heaven. That's one legend. And another legend says that the Waga, this omnipotent God, killed one of his favorite humans in a rage over the human's disobedience. Another version of the story is Waga is mourning over the death of Horo, the first man. See some very interesting connections to other religions here. But upon visiting the grave of this person that he killed, the tears dropped from his eyes to the ground. And surprisingly, the next morning, coffee plants emerged from the ground in these spots. And the Oromos hold that while all other plants are watered by rain, coffee is watered with the tears of God. So then later around the year 1000 AD, Ethiopians concocted a type of wine from coffee berries, fermenting the dried beans in water. And I've also heard of and read about this coffee cherry wine being made in the Middle East, in Yemen as well. So coffee also grew naturally on the Arabian Peninsula, and it was there during the 11th century that coffee was first developed into a hot drink. The so-called stimulating properties of coffee were thought by many during these ancient times to give a sort of religious ecstasy, and the drink earned a very mystical sort of reputation that was shrouded in secrecy and associated with priests and doctors. Interestingly enough, this is kind of seen in other cultures and as history progresses, where this whole concept of this mystical or change of mind that or mind-opening ability of coffee that it actually many people and religions, rulers actually tried to outlaw coffee for fear of what, you know, for fear of people thinking for themselves, heaven forbid. So in 980 AD, the great Arab scholar Avicenna praised coffee for its medicinal value, saying that it cured everything from earaches to eye strain to liver problems. And the Hebrew edition of his greatest work, The Canon of Medicine, was published in Naples in 1491 and an Arabic edition in Rome in 1593 that talked about all of the, these benefits, the great benefits of coffee. In the 11th century in Mecca, a Muslim ruler, Sheikh Abdul Hassan Shadhedi, boiled his Ethiopian coffee in this considered magical water from a free-flowing well and separated the brew from the pit, roasted the pit, crushed it, mixed it with some boiled water, and gave it to townspeople. It's kind of similar to how coffee is prepared today, and gave it to townspeople who were sick with an unknown illness, and the people were cured magically, and the sheikh became a well-known physician based on this. So there is this like ancient history of coffee as being a medicinal herb and plant. The cultivation of coffee began sometime in the 15th century and for many centuries following, all the way up till now, but for a long, long after the 15th century, the Yemen province of Arabia was the world's primary source of coffee. And the demand for coffee in the Near East was very high. The beans leaving the Yemeni port of Mocha for trade with Alexandria and Constantinople were highly guarded. And in fact, no fertile plants were allowed to leave the country. They wanted to have a monopoly on the coffee trade. However, despite the restrictions, Muslim pilgrims were still able to grab some and smuggle some coffee plants from their pilgrimages to Mecca and take them back to their homelands. And the coffee crops soon took root in India. The first Middle Eastern coffee houses opened in the 14th century in what is now known as present-day Yemen, Mecca, Damascus, and Istanbul. Ruling on behalf of the Sultan of Cairo, the governor of Mecca banned coffee in 1511, saying, "In coffee houses, men and women meet and play violins and chess and do other things contrary to our sacred laws." So then he banned coffee completely. However, it was the Sultan realized that the governor had banned the coffee because it was stimulating the common customer of coffee houses to discuss the wrongdoings of the governor and potentially start a rebellion or revolution. So the Sultan actually repealed the ban, discovered the corrupt governor, and unfortunately had him put to death. So very interesting all around this coffee. 1600s. In the 1600s, coffee made its way to Europe via Venice. And then in the early 1700s, the Dutch brought coffee to the Americas. though the drink wasn't really popular in America until the Boston Tea Party of 1773, when making the switch from tea to coffee became somewhat of a patriotic duty and a revolutionary act. And actually, the whole Boston Tea Party was planned in a early coffee house called the Green Dragon. The Civil War and other conflicts that followed also helped to increase coffee consumption, as soldiers relied on the caffeine for a boost of energy. And it seems like in all wars thereafter, coffee became a very important ration and staple for increasing endurance and energy and keeping the soldiers awake and alert. Plus, not only that, but it had this interesting role in revolutionaries both meeting in coffee houses and just this idea of sitting around sipping coffee and, you know, having the mind opened and stimulated to want to change things that weren't working. So I have some interesting statistics here that I got off of just like a little poster that was produced by a company called Lumen Interactive. I just found it online, but it has some fun little things. So let's see, in 1688, coffee replaced beer as New York City's favorite breakfast drink. And the Civil War in the United States elevated the popularity of coffee to new heights. Soldiers went to war with coffee beans as a primary ration. In World War I, the dehydrated packets of coffee were standard in military rations. Between the 40s and the 50s, in the 1940s and 50s, the practice began in World War II era war effort factories to give workers a brief rest and a jolt of caffeine. The American coffee break was put into place. And thanks to a clever advertising campaign by Pan American Coffee Bureau, by the mid-50s, 70 to 80% of American workers were taking a coffee break, both in factories and offices. And I think that that still holds true to today, which is quite interesting to me. So in the middle of the 1700s, tea and coffee were equally favored. Many taverns doubled as coffee houses. And this changed as a result of the Tea Party, as I said. And thereafter, it was unpatriotic to drink tea, so everyone began drinking coffee. The colonists found that they could import coffee from South and Central America, which allowed them to be more free of the British rule. And so drinking coffee became a sign of independence and American autonomy. The founding fathers of the U.S. during the Revolution formed their national strategies in coffee houses. And in the 20s and 30s, after returning from the war, soldiers were so used to drinking coffee several times a day that the number of coffee houses grew 450% in the years following World War I. And also the American diner was born. In the 70s, as we said, that's when Starbucks was born in Seattle. It's 1971, and that's when the coffee imports really took off to be number two in the world. And in between 1995 and 2000, so only 5 years, coffee consumption skyrocketed 700%. And it's still going. So some other interesting statistics. On average, coffee drinkers will spend $164 per year on coffee. I'm sure that is more now. I don't know how dated this poster is. Coffee drinkers that get a cup to go will wait in line for nearly 45 hours or one full work week each year to get their coffee. And 80% of America drinks coffee. I hope that means American adults over the age of 18. And 52% of them drink it every morning. So it is a popular, popular herb in the United States. Second, U.S. coffee drinkers consume about 3 9-ounce cups on average per day, which sounds like a lot to me. But as we'll get into, I think anything under 5 cups is a healthy amount. Are we getting health benefits by drinking coffee? Yes. Yes, we are. Even though it's a very strong herb, and I think it's best taken in small quantities and not overdone, because basically for what it helps in small amounts, it can harm in too large of quantities. And again, that 5 cups of coffee per day is kind of the top end of the healthy, and then anything after that might be too much, depending on how sensitive you are. But coffee improves memory, improves mood, improves reaction time, mental function, endurance, and exercise performance. It's a bitter herb, and so this is, again, if we're drinking our coffee for health benefits, we're going to put hopefully no sugar in it, and maybe very little cream or no cream. So it's a bitter herb that supports liver and digestive functions, as all bitter herbs do. So it's good for the liver, good for digestion in moderate amounts. It's a diuretic herb that can support kidney function in moderate amounts. It's really, overall, from what I can tell, it tends to just be a longevity tonic. So it does a lot of prevention. It's not necessarily going to reverse any health issues from what I can tell, but it's more just kind of supports and nourishes to some degree, and also is known as more of a preventative. So for example, diseases that it's known to prevent would be coronary heart disease and stroke, kidney disease, liver disease, potentially prevent gallstones because it is this digestive bitter. It has laxative action. It can prevent type 2 diabetes. It's been shown to help prevent Parkinson's and progression of dementia, Alzheimer's, and depression. It can decrease DNA breakage, which the DNA, when we say DNA breakage, it's that can lead to cancer or tumors if that DNA is not repaired. And there are specific cancers that it's been shown to help reduce, which would be colon cancer, liver cancer, and skin cancer. Reduced risk of mortality, which I think is odd because, I'm sorry, we're all at risk of mortality. We're all going to die, but it could potentially just extend our lifespan. There are a lot of contraindications potentially. Again, that's if you really start consuming them in large amounts, and especially if you take the caffeine out of the coffee, turn it into a drug, and consume the caffeine. That's where we start getting into a lot of health issues. But like most herbs and herbal medicine, if we're working with the plant in its whole form, then it can actually have a lot of other constituents that kind of help balance out other things that are going on in that plant. So looking at my botanical safety handbook, the American Herbal Products Association, contraindications, none known, nothing too serious, right? So precautions, coffee contains caffeine, a nervous system stimulant. If taken in large amounts, coffee products containing caffeine can cause insomnia, nervousness, and other well-known symptoms of excess caffeine intake. Caution for people with heart disorders, again, but it does have benefits on the heart, but maybe if you take it in too large amounts, or if you already have a heart disorder, then it could increase heart rate or exacerbate arrhythmias. If you're getting heart palpitations, probably not a good time to start drinking lots of coffee, in other words. Sometimes caffeine may aggravate depression and induce anxiety, but then we see in other cases, it can have the opposite effect. So if you have a very gentle, sensitive nervous system, then coffee might not be the best thing for you. Drug and supplement interactions, use use of caffeine, again, this is caffeine, not coffee, but maybe coffee with concentrated amounts of caffeine, with other central nervous system stimulants, including bronchodilators and adrenergic drugs, may cause excessive central nervous system stimulation, resulting in nervousness, irritability, insomnia, and convulsions or cardiac arrhythmias. And it's metabolized by some of the same pathways as some drugs. So there are potential drug information interactions. I don't really want to get into the serious details of all of that now. But basically what this book says is, you know, up to 5 cups of coffee, you're probably okay. But after that, things might get a little wacky. Overdose of coffee may result in restlessness, nervousness, excitement, insomnia, flushed face, frequent urination, stomach ache, nausea, tremors, talkativeness, periods of inexhaustibility, and irritability. Cessation of coffee may result in withdrawal symptoms, which is the addictive part of it, including headache, drowsiness, fatigue, and irritability. And that's basically because you've already pushed your adrenal glands, overstimulated them, and now you have the crash and the sedation that happens afterwards. So that's pretty much, and then again, if you are pregnant or lactating, the caffeine can affect the baby. It can affect the fetus, and it can go through the milk as well. So if you have a baby who's having a hard time sleeping and you're exhausted, so you're drinking coffee so that you can stay up with your baby, and then you're nursing your baby, and then your baby's staying up, it's this, you know, not a really good cycle to get into. So probably if, let's stay away from coffee if your baby is having a hard time sleeping and you're nursing. Okay, so that's mainly from that book. And then the other herbal contraindications and drug interactions book that I have, I was like, when I was first going through my herb books looking for information on coffee, I was like, oh man, the only books I have that have info on coffee or any like sizable info on coffee are the books that say, it's not good for you. There's all these contraindications. But then the more that I read into the contraindications, like so many of the contraindications of other herbs in these books, is that they're all theoretical. Like this could potentially happen. But realistically, when we really get into it, what we see is that it doesn't happen at normal amounts of ingestion. So that's pretty much, you know, like, oh, it could have this effect. However, in this other study, it, you know, it could theoretically have this effect, but then however, in the studies, it shows that it doesn't have that effect, which I think is, quite interesting. So the one other thing that you might see a lot of in relationship to contraindications with coffee is that it potentially has the it has the ability to block iron absorption and magnesium absorption, which would be, so if you're anemic, you might not want to be drinking a lot of coffee. If you have osteoporosis, potentially you don't want to be drinking a lot of coffee, but that was another, however, it hasn't necessarily been shown to be linked to osteoporosis, and that maybe, you know, you'd have to drink a whole lot of coffee for it to actually block magnesium absorption. So I say all in all, short of the long there is have a couple cups of coffee a day, 1 cup of coffee if you want. Don't worry about it. There are benefits to it. But if you start getting edgy or have insomnia or anxiety, then maybe it's not the herb for you. So I'd like to get into how coffee is grown and processed a little bit. And it really is different everywhere. You know, we have the two main varieties, the Arabica and the Robusta, that are grown very differently, as I talked about earlier. But what I find really interesting is that there's this terroir. You know, you hear that word in association to wine. It's the complete natural environment in which a particular wine is produced and how that factors in to its taste. It's the taste based on the soil, the topography, the climate that gives a very characteristic taste of, you know, you could have the same grape grown in two different areas and it's going to taste very different and it's going to be processed differently. And that's very similar to coffee as well. So coffee, you could have Arabica coffee, you might have different varieties of the Arabica beans, and they could be grown in different countries, and you're going to have a very different flavor coffee based on how much water it's been exposed to, the minerals in the soil, how it's processed. So it's a very complex and varied. Coffee is not coffee, just coffee. It's like, it's a whole beautiful rainbow and complexity of a myriad of varieties of plants and flavors and processing. That's really endless if you really want to become a coffee aficionado. I don't really even know what that must have its own word, which I can't think of right now. So the coffee shrub is planted, it blooms, it has fruit that are called cherries that start green and they turn orange and then red, and they're ripe when they're red, and they're either stripped from the plant or they're individually picked. When they're ripe, you might have a variety of cherries that are of different varieties of ripeness on the same plant, so the hand-picked is going to be a lot more precision-based. And then the cherries are processed, and there's either a dry method or a wet method of processing. I think the most common method and the easiest method, as long as there is a water source, is the wet method, which removes the pulp of the fruit from the bean. So it's all about, how do we just get the seed? How do we get the fruit off of the bean? And how do we get the ripe beans only? Because, you know, if you're harvesting a lot of cherries, they're not all going to be ripe at the same time. So it goes through this like water process where it takes the pulp off, and then the cherries are put in, or the beans are put into, which still have a like sugar coating, mucilaginous coating around the bean. And those are put in vats of water and left to ferment. And the fermentation removes that sugary mucilage from off of the bean. And then they're dried. And so that's like a real quick, and then there's a bunch of different types of drying methods too, but you have to be able to ship the bean or to store the bean properly so it won't start molding and mildewing and going bad, then you need it to be at like 11% dryness. I'm sure there's ways that they test that. And that's why we see the coffee beans are all, you know, in these burlap or jute bags. And that's, I would imagine, to allow for respiration and drying as well. And then they go through, there's a hull that is removed often from the bean that's underneath the mucilaginous layer. Once it's dried, then it goes through another process where it's kind of milled, and that skin is removed, that hull is removed, and then they're polished and grated and sorted. So it's lots and lots of steps to get that nice dry green bean that is then shipped around the world. And when it gets to where it's going, then it goes, it's roasted. It's cooked at a specific temperature for a relatively short amount of time. The longer it's roasted, the less caffeine you're going to have. So those really dark roasted coffees actually have less caffeine than a light roast coffee, because the more that you cook a plant, you're going to have less poisons available to you. And this is a theme throughout my podcast, is basically the more that you cook a plant, the more nutrition you gain from it, and the least amount of poisons that you gain from it. And so therefore, the longer a coffee is cooked and roasted, the less poisonous it is. Therefore, the less caffeine it has in it. So ways that we can enjoy coffee. So this other book that I have, Kitchen Witch, Food, Folklore, and Fairy Tale by Sarah Robinson, she was one of the few books that I had that actually talks about coffee. Thank you, Sarah. And she has this little chapter on coffee, and in it she gave these really sweet ideas of how to kind of enjoy your coffee in a more ritualistic way. So I just wanted to share some of these ideas by Sarah Robinson, the Kitchen Witch. One idea is, place intent into your morning coffee by meditating on what the day holds for you as it brews, and think about what you want for the day before you. Another one is, stirring your brew clockwise can invite positivity and growth, and anti-clockwise reduces, banishes, or casts away the undesired. Brew yourself a cup of coffee and try scrying. In a dark, quiet room, light some candles. Gaze into your coffee, your black mirror, and let your mind wander. Consider the darkness of the coffee and think about the dark, rich aspects of your own life. What parts of your life need stimulating? What aspects of the darkness do you enjoy? When you have explored the questions, you can close the practice by drinking your magical brew. Leave a cup of coffee out overnight on a table or the kitchen counter, along with a slice of bread to help keep away ghosts or to appease mischievous spirits. Then finally, she says, I enjoy a cup with my morning yoga practice, savoring the aroma and warmth. It helps me focus, find my grounding, and fills me with gratitude. So those are some fun ideas of ways to ritualize your coffee drinking by Sarah Robinson in her book, Kitchen Witch, Food, Folklore, and Fairy Tale, which is a lovely little book. I highly recommend checking it out. So there's this other part of coffee, this fruit, the coffee cherry that I was talking about, that you can actually make a tea from. And in the modern coffee market, it's named cascara tea, which is the husk or the skin of the coffee cherry tea. And it's likely taken from a dry processed bean, which is where the whole coffee cherry and bean are dried without the water processing. And then it's put through a mill, and that fruit part that has been dried is removed from the bean. And it has caffeine in it, about equal to the amount of caffeine as in black tea. So not as much as in the bean, which has the most amount of caffeine. And we don't want to confuse cascara, the coffee product, from cascara sagrada, which is a buckthorn family plant that's grown in the Pacific Northwest, that is a stimulant laxative. So we don't want that one, probably ever, unless you're in dire needs. But the cascara, the coffee cherry tea, is delicious. It's very kind of tart and almost hibiscus, rosehip-like, and has some of its own benefits. Even though it was made popular today, or about 10 years ago, by a woman named Ada Battle, who's El Salvadorian, a fifth generation coffee grower in El Salvador, who kind of has brought cascara to the modern market. In Yemen, traditionally, cascara was consumed and was named kefir. I might be pronouncing that wrong, but it's a traditional hot beverage that contained spice coffee husks with ginger and cinnamon. And it's usually consumed instead of coffee and is used in religious ceremonies as well. And also as a way of welcoming guests into your home, where you always are offering them this specific spiced tea. And I think it would be delicious with ginger and cinnamon added to it. I've never done that, but I will have to. And I usually just, when I make a cascara tea, I just get the dried cascara and I put it in a quart jar, maybe like a handful or so, and then I pour hot water over it, let it steep, strain it out, and drink it. And it has a nice caffeine buzz to it, but it's not as edgy, I would say, as the coffee bean. I find it more heady and creative. Like if you want to start an art project, or do some homework, schoolwork, then I would probably think about cascara before I would think about the coffee bean. The coffee, the cascara, the coffee berry fruit could be considered a superfood. It's been found to be higher in antioxidants than tea, black tea, green tea, and it's about equal in caffeine to black tea, as I said. It has more vitamin C, vitamin E, and other antioxidants loaded in polyphenols, more so than your standard fruits like raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, cranberries, pomegranate. None of them can compare to the cascara or the coffee berry cherry fruit. It has many health benefits. It's nutritious, as I just explained. It's also known to be able to increase metabolism, so it could be nice if you're trying to drop a few pounds, and reduce inflammation, and has some really nice antioxidant properties. So there is a chemical in the cascara called chlorogenic acid, and in one study, researchers claimed participants who consumed coffee or this cascara that was enriched in the acid had significant decrease in overall weight and belly fat. Another study saw promising results for preventing weight and fat gain in the first place, and it might be because it promotes the breakdown of fat cells. Another interesting thing that cascara offers is it's been shown to increase levels of what's called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is BDNF for short. And these factors promote the growth and protection of cells in our brain. So patients that have Alzheimer's often have lower levels of these BDNFs. And so the cascara is an easy way to help have more of them available in the brain. The these constituents, the BDNF in the brain, can be found in the hippocampus, the cortex, the basal forebrain, which are all areas that are vital to learning, memory, and higher thinking. BDNFs are also expressed in the retina, the kidneys, the prostate, motor neurons, and skeletal muscle, as well as saliva. Very important for long-term memory as well. So that's kind of a fun side product of the coffee plant that we can consume. And if you're interested in finding a nice source of cascara, it is available through my good friends at 44 North Coffee. They have an online website. They are a woman-run and owned coffee roastery here on the island. And you can stay tuned in the future, and I'm going to be interviewing them to find out more about coffee and to add as an adjunct to this episode. But you can check them out. They offer seasonal fair trade organic coffee online and also in their cafes here on the island. Their website's 44 North Coffee and also their Instagram at 44 North Coffee. To learn more about coffee and find a variety of recipes and inspirations, definitely check out the Plant Wonder Collective Instagram account for the month of March. And you can check out their study circle on Patreon. The Plant Wonder Collective study circle on Patreon is here to help you further your studies of your plants of the month with recipes, study materials, printables, and more. Think of them as an organized way to dive deeper into herbalism one plant at a time without having to sign up for extensive and expensive herb school. Plus, they don't quiz you at the end of the month. From daily reminders of the plant properties on your wallpaper backgrounds to journal workbook sheets and membership-only blog content, they pave the way so you can amble down the plant path, soaking up herbal magic along the way while inspiring your own exploration too. They offer three tiers, so there's something for everyone: the plant dabbler, the home student, and the medicine maker. Plant Wonder Collective also publishes the beautiful Botanical Anthology, which is this beautiful magazine available both in digital and printed copies, that is a seasonally inspired plant-centered publication. So you can check that out on the website, Plant Wonder Collective. And I hope that this has been interesting to you. I know coffee can get a bad rap out there in the herbal world, or I know for me, for a long time, I was very anti-coffee. And then I got into coffee and I do enjoy it. And it's been really fun and intriguing and interesting, kind of diving into the realm of coffee, learning all about the plant, the benefits it offers, and how to have a healthy relationship with this very common herb. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate you. If you appreciate me too, I'd love a 5-star rating and a short review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts if they offer that option. I value your feedback. Thank you so much. And please subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, my website, all under the tag Solidago Herb School. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Bridget Daugherty. Until next week, be well, let intuition guide you, and have fun with herbs.